you have a bunch of predictors, if you like, or risk factors, I guess, that are a bunch of risk factors that were measured at the beginning. I think they measured, they kept remeasuring. Let's see, did they keep remeasuring the risk? Yeah, I think they kept remeasuring the risk factors too at every two-year visit. I think they did. But, you know, you could use the initial risk factor profile as the main one for now. So he had 70 or 80 or 100 heart attacks or heart disease, new, that wasn't there on the first exam. And then he had all these covariates that they thought were important. At the time, actually in the very first exam in Framingham, half of the people don't have a cholesterol measurement. In the first exam in 1948, half the people don't have a cholesterol measurement. And I'm saying, what the hell's going on? Why could they miss all that much data? What's the real reason? We go back to 1948. That was the dark days when they didn't know much. They didn't even suspect that cholesterol could be a big issue in heart disease. Somebody got the idea halfway through the first wave and they stuck it in as fast as they could. And then from each wave onwards after that, cholesterol is measured on everybody. So you're missing cholesterol for the first wave, but you could substitute the one from 2 years later if you're stuck, right? If you're doing it again. Yeah. So that's Framingham. So how would you analyze that back then? What tools did you have available to you? Today, you would probably immediately think of logistic regression, right? So you have the probability y equals 1 would be heart attack within the 7 or 10 years since the beginning, and y equals 0 would be non-heart attack, right? And that's logistic, and then the rest is all on the right-hand side, right? You don't have to use logit, you could use some other link, but anyway, that was the easiest one, right? But back then, there was no such thing. So what techniques, what other techniques could you have? There was an old technique, and it's still very, very, it's used in some areas, but it's still very logical to people. And it's a technique I learned in 1970 as well, called discriminant analysis. Anyone hear of discriminant analysis? Discriminant analysis used to be this. Let's say we have only two variables that you're dealing with. Just a second now. No, it's just quit. Don't save. New. Discriminant analysis was this. Let's say you had just two variables, x1 and x2, to keep it easy. And this could be blood pressure, and this could be cholesterol. Right? So, when you talk about discriminant analysis, or discrimination, which is another word that's still used today in classification, what's the idea? You're trying to pick a linear combination of the X's that what? Maximally separates who? Who does it maximally separate?
Heart attack.
The heart attack and the other. So you would plot here in one color, right? You would plot the data for the heart attack people, right? Those would be the values for the heart attack people, right? And there's 78 of those or 100 of those. Then you would plot the same two values, the same pair, for the others, right? And where do you think they'd be? Presumably over here somewhere, right? See what I mean? So that's discriminant analysis. So it's basically coming at it in the kind of a case control logic after the fact. What is it that separates the two groups? Whereas I think of logistic regression as before the fact. Can you predict who's going to be in the one group afterwards? Or whatever. This is after the fact. Thinking. See what I mean? But right. So that's discriminant analysis. And what do you do in discriminant analysis? You find the linear combination of x1 and x2 that maximally separates them. So it has to be, let's say it was 1/3 cholesterol plus 2/3 blood pressure, that would draw a line somewhere here, and so it would reduce everything to a scalar,
you'd be trying a whole bunch of different X.
Yeah, just like you do in regular regression.
Right.
Yeah, and you're fitting a best one in some sense. Yeah, and the idea is to get maximal discrimination. You could have two dimensions or three or four. They still use it today. Like there's a first discriminant analysis, a first discriminant. It's like a first factor. What's the word? Not factor analysis. What's the other one? Principal components. It's kind of like that in a certain sense. Is that you're looking for the component that maximally separates, and you can then talk about it. So that might be this component here might maximally separate the two groups, right? You could also try a second discriminant analysis then, which would go this way, which maximally separates them on a second dimension, and so on. So that's discriminant analysis. Right? And that technique has been around for 40 years before that. Fisher and them were using discriminant analysis. There's still data sets in the thing like the IRIS data set, and those, if you ever see them on the packages, that had characteristics of different categories and so on. And it was sort of used sometimes for classification as well, because what you do then is you put them a new observation closest to whichever group. Right? I think it's still kind of used today, isn't it? Yeah, you come up with this, and then you can measure a distance from here and to here, and you can put the next observation closer to whichever or whatever. So it's not that far off from some of the things we do today. Yeah. So that's discriminant analysis. But in order to fit that, that was fine, and you can say this linear combination maximally separates people. And I guess the weighting of which variables mattered more comes into the linear combination. So that would help you with that. Right? Yeah. So that's what he did. So let's see if we look at his paper. Yeah. And I forget how many he had now. How many cases he had. Yeah. During the period, 92 developed heart disease. So he has 92 in the red group and all the rest of them in the other group. So you would think of logistic regression today because you have all the initial variables, but he was thinking of it a different way. And now, does that look like anything to you? Does that look like something to you? That looks like logistic regression, right? Because he's talking about the probability of Y as a function of other things. I don't know why these aren't X's. Oh, no, yeah, the P, in any case. These are the variables he's going to use. Yeah, but the way he thought of it is as a linear discriminant. Yeah. And so basically what he did, to speed up the story, in linear discriminants, one of the problems is, and this is why it was a limitation, you ended up making the assumption that this was, or you didn't have to, but it was helpful, if you said the red distribution has a bivariate normal distribution. So the red distribution is bivariate normal, centered on this mean and this mean, and it has a certain variance and a certain covariance. You know, like there'll be covariance between. And this one has a different bivariate normal, centered down lower probably, or away from the other one, but with this, restrictively, also normal, bivariate normal, but also with the same variance, which is a bit of a stretch to think that everything is going to be nice and clean. But it was a beginning of a model, right? And the beauty of it is that if you have two normal distributions with the same mean and with the same covariance pattern and only shifted by their means, and then you try and do this calculation, which is the Bayes one here, right? Wherever it is, this one. That's sort of a Bayes thing, because it says now, you're now trying to switch it. In this one, you're trying to say, what's the probability of Y given X? But the model is about the probability of X given Y, isn't it? When I drew my diagram, it's the probability of the X's given Y. You split on the Y, right? Red and green and blue. And then you try to model the X's. And that's kind of a crazy thing to be doing, modeling the X's. What you really wanted to do is say, given the X's, what will happen to the expected value of Y? Right? So you're flipping it around to the natural scientific way. So it was easy to model the X's by making assumptions about normality, but he's now clearly wanting to get to the probability of Y as a function of the X. And there you have in here priors, and the priors have to do with, I know ahead of time, the probability of Y given anything is, it's 92 relative to 1,000 and something. So the beginning of it is the 92 over something. You see, that's there. This one and this one. Right? Kind of as an intercept. But then that'll get moved around by where you are in the X space. Right? So that's the idea of it. So he basically took the going way at the time, which was discriminant analysis, which didn't, it just said, oh, they're different. But if somebody said, Doc, what are my chances of getting heart disease? You couldn't give it to them. You could just show them the diagram and say, cholesterol matters, the other one matters more, they separate the people, but they couldn't give a probability in the Y scale. So the whole point of this was to go the other way around and reverse it. Right? So now, by this trick, but it's very restrictive because of the assumptions of the bivariate X's, normality, he got back, and you see now, he has written, look at this thing. It turns out that that's the same as the equation I wrote down. That's the logistic equation. The only reason that works as cleanly as that is that he made assumptions of bivariate or multivariate normality and that the two sigma matrices are the same. So that's a bit heavy. And so people say, well, look, come on, some of the X's aren't even quantitative. So one of the X's is male or female. Another of the X's is smoker or not. So you can't have bivariate, trivariate, whatever normality for X's when some of them aren't even X's, or, you know, normal. So people didn't like that, but it was a good start. And it was a huge start in that it turned discriminant analysis around and turned it the other way so you can make fitted probabilities which are much more relevant to the public than the discriminant analysis one. Right?
That transformation is to make it normal, right?
What?
You actually transform the X.
Where you...
Oh,
well, yeah, but that, yeah, those are details about the X's on the X side. Yeah, but the stuff on the X side barely changes anything. He could use cholesterol squared. Nothing in any of our GLMs changes on the X side. The issue is on the Y side, yeah. But you're right, he probably did that to make the thing more normal, right? Yeah, so he had to do a lot of stuff to get things to be a bit more normal, but, I mean, certainly smoking or not, won't be normal, gender won't be normal, that sort of thing. So, yeah. But he was fussed with that, yeah. But anyway, he got started, and the good thing was, he was able to then, you see, there are the raw data, the way you would think of them, right? This is events, 93 events out of this many in total, and then he can spread that risk function out by blood pressure and cholesterol, you see? So he's doing it empirically here. So clearly, if you're up at this end, look at this. If your cholesterol is this high and your cholesterol, you know, your risk here is 25%. And your risk down at this corner is only 4%. So he's trying to get a function that goes in the two directions. Yeah. And I think it was a big step ahead. Yeah. You see? And he says, you can do what you want now. But now he's getting in trouble with the assumptions and then multivariate normality and all that. Right, but the good thing is he has predicted and observed, you see, all things he can do now just by the trick of turning things around. I guess when we learned discriminant analysis as well, we did know that people were important to know what would you do with a new observation? For which group does it belong to? And it wasn't enough to say yes, no, you had to have sort of a probability. Because just making it, and I think that's what I guess. Does classification mean you just call it one way or the other, typically?
Yeah.
Yeah? Whereas this is saying we're not that good at that. Let's just give you a probability instead of calling it one way or the other. And I think that's what's nice about this. And then you can sort of see a bit more carefully how well it's fitting and so on. Right? Yeah. So that's the beginning of logistic regression of the medical era. Right? And then... What happened then? Where did I go back? If I go back now to 67, Then the mathematicians got involved. You can tell they're mathematicians. And they got very fancy then. Now, Cannell is in it, actually. Oh, so Cornfield is there. No, Doc, Walker, and Doc. So this is another one. I think that's still using the discriminant analysis, but these guys are Walker and Duncan, and you can tell they're in a paper, in a journal called Biometrica, which is the most rigorous of the statistical journals. They now, right, they talk about how Cornfield had tried this, and they're saying, yeah, this is what you'd have as your X's, but look, why do we go there? Why don't we go right away to this? You see? So there's their equation. It's the same logistic equation that Cornfield came up with, but they're saying, let's start with that. Let's not even go back to the discriminant, the multivariate normality, anything. Right? And then, what's this about? I don't know. This is about the probate analysis, doing it that way, you see, doing it kind of that. But instead of the probate, the logistic is more tractable mathematically and better suited. So they're basically saying now, what function should I use here? This is the loaded version. It's easier than this probate version, because you don't have any intervals, you just had to take logs and so on. And they went straight ahead then, and they said, look guys, we're not making any assumptions about the x's now. Come on, the uncertainty is in the y. Why should we model the x's? They're just given to us. And it's my attitude as well that in regression, the x's are not to be modeled. They're to be taken and used for the y. So why spend a lot of time about all the structure and the correlation among the x's? It's not your primary objective. Your primary objective is to map to the y. Right? And treat the x's as, I think of the x's in a regression as constants. That happened to be, you either got them or you designed them and measured at those places. But I don't care after that about what, where they are. So that's the point then. The logistic is more tractable mathematically, it has fewer calculations, and so on and so on. And then, I presume he's going to put here, how did you estimate it? I presume he's going to estimate it by maximum likelihood. Maybe not. He has an initial guess just to get your initial ones with this. And I don't remember now anymore what he does. Iteratively reweighted least squares. So he's actually he's doing it that way. Not realizing, I think, does he use the word maximum likelihood ever? Here? It's not obvious. But it is iteratively reweighted, which happens to be maximum likelihood. So that's the beginning of logistic regression. And the equations, do they look, to those who've taken stats and biostat, do those look similar to you? Huh? What's that? If you had no W in the middle, what would that be? It would be a regular regression. It's the least squares one. If you have a W in the middle, what does it mean? You're weighting by variance. Because the point of logistic and these other ones is that in regular regression, the epsilon in the end is supposed to be normal or something, zero, sigma squared, right? That sigma squared isn't supposed to change depending on where you are in the x scale. It's homoscedasticity, all this stuff, right? So it's only one sigma squared and it doesn't move, right? The problem in binomial is what's the unit variance in a binomial or in a Bernoulli? A Bernoulli is a 0-1 variable governed by the probability pi. Probability, right? 0 to 1. What's the unit variance of a Bernoulli? Single Bernoulli. Pi times 1 minus pi. Where is that maximum?
At
0.5. It's a quarter at 0.5. It's a half times a half. What is it at 0.1? It's 0.09. It's 0.01. That's 0.1 times 0.9. It's 0.09. So there's a lot tighter at that end and the other end. Now, what about the logit? Which variance is higher? Where's the logit variance higher? You see, what we're saying is the binomial variance is smallest at the two ends. Where's the logit unit variance largest and smallest? Not you, but the other math people here. Come on. Pi 1 minus pi is smallest in the middle. Biggest in the middle and smallest at the edges. The log of pi hat over 1 minus pi hat, what about the variance of that? Because that's the logit. Where's that variance highest and lowest? It's a whole different scale now. It turns out that's most stable at 0.5, smallest variance, and as highest variance is a way out to the end. Because you have one big ratio and one small ratio, you have, you know, instead of a half over a half, if you have 0.9 over 0.1, that's less stable than 0.5 over 0.5. So the variance is changing in a different way. So that's why the W is in here. Because depending on where you are with which particular observations, the W will kind of rescale things to say, look, that's not as stable as another proportion somewhere else in the data. That's the idea. So anyway, this is logistic regression done in 1967. Then came Neldren Wedderburn to do the whole thing in one shot. So you no longer have separate programs for everything. You have one program and you switch the link and you switch the error. Whereas before this, people made up their own program for everything. Right? So even though they were doing the same thing, all of them, with just different weights, you could figure that out with the GLM. So that's why I think David Stevens is right. Actually, the 1972 paper by Neldren Wedderburn is a bigger breakthrough in statistics than the Cox model. It's a broader thing for GLM, for everything. And the Cox model is overused anyway. But so that's why are we gone away from that? We've gone away from that because we were talking about what you might use for logistic regression for the Oscars. Now, but the one extra complication in the Oscars is this. Can you see what it is? So think of the Framingham data set. You have 100 winners, losers, who got a heart attack, and 1,000 competitors, right? In the Oscars, you have 80 times 4, 320 winners, and 1,000 losers, right? But looks the same, right? More variables. Some variables missing at the front, but besides that, there's something else that's fundamentally different that you mightn't think of immediately when you, because you could rush now to use logistic regression on it, right? And I guess I don't know whether you're going to use separate logistic regression for establishing the best movie, and another logistic regression for using the best actor and so on like that. I guess you're thinking four regressions. Pardo seemed to be doing one big master regression, but I couldn't figure it out. But so I think of it as four models, one for each separately. But he thinks there's something to be gained from putting them all together. But where's the extra complication? And so now let's go to his paper. And it's a very nice paper. If I can find it now. Can you see the complication? Bio 602, so... I can remember where it is. Conditional logistic regression. Let's see if this is it. Yeah. I'll send you these links anyway. Yeah, so this is Ian Pardo. That's still his website. Okay. So he lives out in a nice part of the country. We've tried to get him to come here, but he doesn't seem to want to. You know, I think it's too nice out there. And so every year he's been doing this. Oh, and he has a nice regression textbook. Sounds like a nice guy. Here's his predictions for all the years past. So he's already made his model. But I hope he doesn't tell you the model. Right? I'm presuming he doesn't. Right? But now, here's the article that I think is good, that's worth reading, and it explains what's going on. And you will see in it, but with a complication, what we would have done with our S curve is the probability of winning would be e to the some linear combination of the variables over 1 plus that. Right? That would be the S-shaped function. But you'll see something similar here. And this is interesting because just the very words he uses at the beginning are interesting because they come from a different culture again. I was talking about the discriminant analysis culture, the logistic regression culture in toxicology, the logistic regression or probate in our area and in others. And there's another one, and this is was quite annoying to Norm Breslow, who's a president of one of the big statistical societies in the early 2000s, and he said, how come statisticians don't get Nobel Prizes? And the economists do. Why? And he said, economists have gotten the Nobel Prize for something that's basically the model in here. And he's called McFadden, is his name. He's from the University of Chicago, like an awful lot of the Nobel laureates. Heckman is another one, but he's more unbiased than causal inference. But McFadden got the Nobel Prize in the early 2000s for basically discrete choice models. And you look at it, and Breslow looks, he says, shoot, that's the same as we've been doing for 30 years. How come we didn't get the Nobel Prize? Well, part of the problem is that there's no Nobel Prize for mathematics or statistics. First of all, economics can make it look... Yeah, anyway, there is one. Yeah. So, discrete choice is interesting because when you go back to what McFadden is about, McFadden was doing his PhD, I think, in San Francisco, and they were looking at who rides, not the subway we call it here, the BART system in San Francisco, whatever that's called, the Rapid Transit, BART, Bay Area Rapid Transit System. They were trying to find out who takes the metro and who doesn't, and who takes cars and who chooses this and who chooses that, right? So they were trying to explain to people, or, you know, understand who does and can we change, and I guess target certain people to see if you could change their attitude. So how would you study that? The fact, what kind of people and what factors influence people to choose one kind of transport over another? And he also said, you could be talking about this for a car company. Who chooses Toyota rather than something else? Right? It's in a simpler version of it. So how would you study that? This is a bit of a cultural difference, but a very smart thing he did from a data collection point of view. This is not about the model now. This is about the data collection. So if somebody asked you to do this for Toyota versus the other, what would you do?
Compare costs.
Well, you'd look at all the various factors and you'd ask, but you'd interview a bunch of people, right? Why is it you chose this over that? But how would you start to get that sample? I'm not worried about the measurement of the various things you would consider, but who would you get to be in the survey? That's my first point. Now, this is where they were sort of clever, but sensible, but when you see it, makes sense.
Because the new car buyers?
Yeah, okay. Right? So you're right, I mean, the first eligibility is you have to be thinking about getting a new car or getting a car or whatever. Yeah, but what else? Okay, that's a start.
What if you switched between the two before? Like, what if you bought, like, originally had one type of...
Oh, okay, yeah, too complicated, but right. Yeah, okay. But let's just keep it to first time. Or it could be whoever has adopted something or not adopted something, something completely new. You know, who has a cell phone and who doesn't, right? Well, there are not many who don't, but there's a few of us, right? But, yeah, but the point is, where would you start collecting data for that? How would you start? We can immediately talk about modeling the probability of being a cell phone user or not once we have the exits, but how do you collect them? That's my point. How do you collect them? Where do you go? Okay, so let's say in the Toyota case, where are you going? Toyota is the one who's commissioned you to do the study. What distinguishes our customers from other customers? That's another way of thinking of it, isn't it? Yeah. What variables distinguish us? So where would you head first?
Insurance company?
You mean the banks? Yeah. Oh, insurance, okay. And what did you tell them? Give me a list of... Well, I know, but let's try. Let's say they were willing to sell it. Yes. Yeah, but which sample? Let's say you have to interview these to get the extra information. Because let's say this is beliefs and other things. It isn't something you're going to find in the database, right? So let's say it's beliefs and, you know, so you're going to have to interview them. So, and you have a budget of 500 people that you're going to do. So now the question is, where do you spend your 500? That's my question. So who would you order? And you're going to get a list of 500 from the insurance company. Yeah, I like that. Which 500 would you ask for? This is basic epi, basic design now, basic efficiency, basic whatever. Huh? And the study is for Toyota, by the way. So Toyota are going to be paying you for this.
So we're only interested in Toyota versus everybody else?
Yeah, just Toyota versus everyone else, just for now. Yeah, Toyota is doing the survey, it wants the answer. Yeah, just to keep it simple. Just to keep it simple.
Like a 50-50 split of Toyota and anyone else.
Aha. Uh-huh. See what I mean? Why are you doing that?
Well, we care about Toyota compared to everyone else, so and it makes a balance.
Because if you just said, give me a random sample, what would happen? A random sample of 500. What would happen? Toyota has 4% market share, so you'd get 20 Toyota people and 280 non-Toyota. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah, exactly. So you go for, yeah, so you guys know this in this business. I forget that you have names for it even, about the mixing of, what's the word you use? Majority and minority and all that kind of thing.
Class imbalance?
Imbalance. Imbalance, class amounts, yeah. So you instinctively know that there's more information in comparing half Toyota with half that, right, than the other way around. And there's a very good reason that if you go to logistic regression, the variance of the odds, or whatever it is, or even any odds ratio, is 1 over A plus 1 over B plus 1 over C plus 1 over D. Do you know that formula? If you have a 2x2 table with just one factor you're looking at, and you want to come up with an odds ratio or something that says these kind of people are more likely to buy a Toyota than not, or than others, the variance of the log of that odds ratio is 1 over A plus 1 over B plus 1 over C. And what are A, B, C, D? A and B are the Toyota people who have one factor or not that factor. And C and D are the other people who have that factor or not that factor. Right? The exposure, we'd say, or the predictor. See what I mean? So those are the four cells. So what do you want to do to make that small? You want to make, don't you want to make the variance small? Isn't that the whole idea? To get the most out of your 500? So this is, let's say, the Toyota people. And this is the non-Toyota. Plus 1 over C plus 1 over D. And this here is the factor, positive and negative for the factor, right? Whatever factor you're looking at, right? So what's the best way to minimize? You want to minimize that variance. Isn't that right? So it helps a lot if you start with 500 here and 500 here. That's a good start. Because if you start in a natural setting, you might have 20 here, and this might be 1 over 8 and 1 over 12. And this is 1 over a huge number and 1 over a huge number. So wasted time, wasting all your time, getting this very precise and this very imprecise. So that's the instinct behind your 500 and 500. So, we've been talking this in a Toyota, non-Toyota thing. What's the epi lingo for this kind of study? The epi terminology for this kind of study. Because you see what he called it? What did he call it? Economics? He wasn't even thinking choice model. He wasn't even thinking of buying. He was thinking of choice to do something or not. So, this is Toyota or not, rapid transit or car. Right? What's the epi equivalent of this? Case control studies. Actually, now that I think about it, it's not a very expressive word. See, that's why they get the Nobel Prize. They know what to talk about. We could talk to the public about who chooses this and that, right? Choice. But there's another word in epi that would be better than case control. Because the basic thing here is they didn't go and pretend to be going forward. They went back. And they were optimized about who they picked. So what's choice? Choice means cases or control, right? But that's a terrible word. It doesn't help much. What would the a better word in epi be? A broader word than that. That would... You, where, they'd understand you if you're on the radio. If you talk case control, people won't understand what you're talking about.
Healthy sick. Healthy sick or alive and dead.
Yeah, but and then now let's get more generic than that. Even more generic. Yeah, that's true. Healthy sick, that's what it is. Yeah, or this and that. Yeah, okay, but come on. One more. But the important thing is, which variable is this in the regression? Is it on the left-hand side or the right-hand side? It's on the left-hand side. So I think today, the generic name for this is outcome-based sampling. Outcome-based. Outcome is not as good as choice. That's why they do better. Outcome is too generic. Choice-based, everyone gets it. Right? But outcome-based is what we're talking about. Why-based sampling, isn't it? Yeah. Which is case-controlling. You start with 500 cases of something who got lung cancer and 500 people who didn't. That would be the most efficient design, right? Instead of the other way around, some other mix. So outcome-based sampling is what it is. Or case-controlling if you want to stick with that. But you see, go with these guys who know how to get the big prize. So anyway, that's what he did. So he says, why that's a model that McFadden used. And yeah. And then, let's see the rest of it. Let's go down here. He has a couple of figures. Data. So anyway, this is all his data. See? And how we started collecting. This was back in 2008. So it's 12 years ago. So we've been adding to his data set ever since, ourselves. I think, I don't know if he keeps his up to date or gives it to us or not, or maybe he is restricted. Yeah. So this is the various things. So that's why we picked those four types, because that's what he has. And this is, I guess, important. Yeah. Anyhow. Come on. He has a lot of data here first. Where's these models? My God, estimation. Yeah. Now, see? For experiment I. I don't know why it's called experiment I. These are not experiments, by the way. The Oscars are not experiments. Are they? They're real. Experiment means you're manipulating something. This is just observation. They're not experiments. So he's showing his statistical training here, his old statistical training. Because everything in math stat was an experiment when I was a student. Everything. Still, Lawrence Joseph, all of them still talk about experiments. X's. We got it from an experiment. In math stat, isn't that right? Experiment is the data generating process. If you flip a coin, that's an experiment. I'm saying, no, it's not. You haven't changed anything. You're just observing. So in statistic, experiment means a data generating or data collection process. Experiment in science means what? What's the essential element of experiment in science?
You control the exposure, or you assign the exposure?
You assign the exposure, I guess, yeah. You intervene, or you change something, yeah? And what else? Does it have to be randomized? Does it have to be randomized? No, that's an extra bonus. The main thing is you're in control, and you can decide who gets what. Right? Or when to change or who to change or anything else. There's one other essential piece. And Mietnin gives this lovely example. He says, you go to the doctor for something else, chest cold or something like that, or antibiotics. And you're leaving and you're walking out the door and the doctor says, do you ever get a rash? I say, yeah, sometimes I get a rash. He says, I said, why are you asking? He says, well, the guy from the pharmaceutical company, the rep, left a whole bunch of samples here. He gave me a bunch of samples for free to give out to patients, right? So, you get a rash on it? Okay, do you want to take one of these and, okay? See if it works, right? Is that an experiment? When the doctor says to you, try this if you want. Is that an experiment? In Mietnin's mind, it's not. And what's missing from it? What would make it an experiment? He did. He told you, try it if you want. Because presumably the other is don't do anything or do